the fiscal cliff nonsense is a perfect example of how politics in Western democracies has been directed by the 1% away from promising opportunity and at least nominally working for a better future, and rather towards threatening and taking away what the 99% already has. Of note is the seemingly wanton destruction that today's elite in America and elsewhere seem intent on inflicting on the economy through the policies of their puppets. It has become clear that they are more concerned with impoverishing most people than further enriching themselves, though they seek both results. So, did you hear that Al Gore is getting involved in the fiscal cliff issue?
I have not heard that, but I was tuned to this podcast for the latest and greatest in what's going on in the news.
Well, Al Gore, the former vice president of the United States back in the 90s, he's warning of the, quote, climate cliff, unquote.
What is this climate cliff?
I don't know.
I think it's where they want to charge people for their existence.
Yeah, the carbon tax. Yeah, I mean, that's actually what it says in the first sentence of this article on thehill.com. Gore warns of, quote, climate cliff, end of single quote, pushes carbon tax in, single quote, fiscal cliff, end of single quote, clause, talks. The fiscal cliff is just this fake issue where it's a perfect encapsulation of what we have now in the political system where, you see what people are doing. Like, I mean, I think what Al Gore, I think, is just trying to ride herd on the story where, Congress set up the fiscal cliff, and they set it up so that if, nothing was done by the end of the year, then all these different policies with fiscal implications take hold, including the end of the Bush-era tax cuts, to which I say good riddance, but then also this thing called sequestration, which apparently will cut funding for a lot of government activity, which is good in the sense that it could cut the military, but not good that it might cut other government spending. I mean, government spending is largely what keeps the economy going.
A lot of people don't realize that. And they are convinced that the 1% is really out there to screw us.
Which they are.
Don't you think?
Well, oh, yeah.
I mean, I think if people just start to wake up and realize they're not getting any benefits the way things are going, and they're not giving us basic things like healthcare. They're not giving us basic things like women's rights and human rights.
Well, there's a story where they're not really giving people their right to the constitutional Fourth and Fifth Amendments, where, you have the right against search and seizure and self-incrimination. There's someone we talked about. On a previous podcast called Leah Lynn Plant, and it was in podcast 55. She's been released from federal prison, but there's a couple of other people that were associated with her in some way, named Matt Duran and Kitty O. Olejnik. Catherine Olesnik, I guess, they are still in custody. This article I linked to is from late October, but apparently they're still in custody. So, you know, people that just don't want to testify about some kind of protest event that the feds are saying they know something about or something like that, you know, and they just, you know, they're in prison because they don't want to testify.
It's just a sad state of affairs, and as Americans, we need to take back our country and make it the awesome place that it can and should be. Freedom, you know, to be who you want to be, to be yourself with no restrictions other than just a few simple ones, you know, so that we can all protect that space to be who we are and to be great and to be a great nation, to be caring and compassionate, considerate. And, you know, there's only so much money in the world, and, you know, that's not really what it's about anyway. And hopefully people will start to realize that.
Well, that would be a great revelation if people started realizing that. That would be a mass change in attitude.
Yeah, and it would be much better than the revolution that Donald Trump talked about.
Yeah, so, later on we're going to talk about how Donald Trump may be messing up Macy's brand. And, you know, the guy has just said some incredibly stupid things, you know. Now, also, we're going to hear from the president. Something that people won't be buying at the counter are $69 Donald Trump ties. Yeah, Donald Trump. I mean, what do you think of this story? Why don't you tell me your take on it? I mean, this is, they said it looked like that he's losing women as Macy's customers even worse than men, but it's not helping with men.
Yes. So I think that we have really reached a stage where the consumer base is demanding a higher level of excellence from anyone and everyone that they interact with, including companies. It's a paradigm shift in how relationships are formed, and social media right now is really a big part of that, and how people communicate, how they're different when they communicate on Facebook versus Twitter. And I think that, I think I read that Macy's CEO defended him and said, you know, it's nothing to do with politics.
Yeah, you know, was a CEO of like, some spokesperson, yeah.
It's everything to do with politics. It's everything they, to do with it your brand. It doesn't
constitute an endorsement of politics because they're involved with Trump? Like, are you kidding? This is a guy who, constantly inserts himself in politics, even though he doesn't know what he's doing and he's never had any success in that field.
Macy's is a house of brands, and they have chosen to have Donald Trump in there. And I guess what I read was he's been in there since 2005. So what's happening is consumers are like, uh-uh. He just said a bunch of stuff about our president, called for a revolution, you know, and then the ads play to this concept where there's one with Kris Kringle, Santa Claus, and Donald Trump was like, I don't believe you. Let me tug on your beard. So this whole thing, right?
Are you kidding? There's a commercial like that.
So they are playing on that celebrity, right? And they are endorsing it. They are building an ad campaign which speaks to their company. It's coming. It's communicating.
So they're communicating their brand directly on commercials with him. There's no question that they're associating themselves with him.
So the CEO was clearly unprepared and then poor planning. And now it's at a time when you get data points like this and you get stories about your brand like this that can hurt you. Now, here's my thing. There's been a lot of things going on, and I wonder if there's another side to the story.
Cool. We'll get to that coming up next after this little musical interlude where we're playing a composition called The Disintegration Loops 3 by William Bestinsky.
It could be like a story about a cat duck. It's half cat and half duck.
I like that. Go on.
You know, like, cats don't like to swim in the water, but a cat duck does.
But it doesn't like to do all the stuff that only one of them likes to do, or does it not like to do all the stuff that one of them doesn't like to do?
I don't know. I haven't thought that hard about it.
Well, I definitely think that it should just be, it just needs to be fleshed out, and we go from there. The app that I talked about on podcast 32 called Read Later is now, kind of has a predecessor app. I got a message. I was in the app and I got a message by opening the app that there is a new, app, an official Pocket for Mac app. So instead of the Read Later app, which was like a Read It Later and Later Pocket client for the Mac desktop, apparently the developer of Read It Later said he was working with Pocket to develop their official app. But whoever developed it, there's now an official Pocket app that actually has some similarities to Read Later, but it's got a little bit different design. And I think it, it seems to work pretty well. So now, for people with Mac, there's a free client, official, first party, from Pocket. So if you use that service for your Read Later tools, and I would recommend using that one. I've tried other ones, and I think Pocket's the best. You can download those apps for free.
Yeah.
Check it out at getpocket.com if you want to look at it.
I'm very interested in this sort of sharing of brands in the social space, like the fact that now on the iPhone, in the new operating system, iOS 6, you can share directly to Facebook and a lot of other options as well.
Oh, yeah. Facebook and Twitter logins are both built into iOS. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just, it's just becoming a very different kind of world. And I see some possibilities here with technology, you know, and things going a good way. And this is a good app to try to kind of see the integration.
Yeah, because then, you know, you get, like, let's say, you know, you're on your browser, like Chrome, you can get a Chrome plugin, and then anytime that you're at a web page that you want to read later, you just hit the Pocket, you know, plugin, you know, button on Chrome, and then you can read that article later. It'll save that article.
And that's nice because, you know, you can use it in areas where your signal might not be so great, and just be able to quickly read through things. It's nice.
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? If you run the app on your smartphone before you go somewhere, then you or your tablet or whatever, then, you know, even if you're out of signal, it'll have a bunch of articles cached. And that's the thing, like, I actually downloaded hundreds of articles onto the local client when I first downloaded Pocket. So that's one thing, when you install it and give it your login, if you have a lot of articles that you're planning to read at some point, but you've been using Pocket for long enough that you've built up like hundreds like I have, then, you know, they'll load in. But that's fine, because now, you know, basically my Mac, I think, basically has a lot of article content, you know, offline. Although, you know, some, you know, and it'll save some articles better than others, but it works pretty well for most of the stuff that you're going to want to put, you know, in your read later list. Because there's a crude functionality, you know, like Safari read later list or something, that's similar, that's built into some Mac, you know, Mac stuff. But I would recommend, you know, using Pocket right now. And, you know, for other apps, I was looking at iBooks and Kindle, and I noticed something when I was working on using Pages to create EPUB books. So I was working on trying to do that to see what goes into publishing stuff with the EPUB format. And, you know, actually, if you want to see EPUB version, it's actually, not all the images seem to come through, and it's kind of strange as to which ones, and the formatting isn't quite right. But I went through and got rid of all the blank chunks of nothing after transferring it from the PDF version that had been output by iBooks Creator. That was the one that seemed to come in cleanest, Pages, and then I outputted it after cleaning it up a little. But some stuff, it just was hard to transfer because of the type of book. It was a laid out, you know, book with two columns, but laid out for that iBooks author. But so now that, but I have a version. So if you go to the site for the book, so, you know, go to djmcloud.com check the link for my book, or go to danmckeown.info/book. And you can see that there's now a third option, and it's for EPUB. So I did publish with EPUB, and you know, but it's not really quite as good as the PDF or the iBooks iPad version, but it's readable on like iPhone. So, you know, compromises. One of the things I noticed while doing this is that if you come up with an EPUB, now I know that I'm using Pages, and then I'm putting it in iBooks, and that's Apple device to, you know, Apple program to Apple program. But Apple, I think you can make EPUBs in other tools. Now, I did try a couple other tools I could download for free, and they were very frustrating. So that's why I got Pages. But maybe I just couldn't figure them out. I'm not even gonna name them, because, you know, I'm not really criticizing. It was just, they weren't, you know, what I was looking for. But the ebook creators, I think you can create an EPUB fairly easily with different EPUB, you know, creators, and then you can still, I think, basically sideload those into iBooks. So you go to the site, a site that has a link to it, you click on the link in your like iOS Safari, and then it gives you an option to open in iBooks if you have iBooks installed. So iBooks will read your EPUBs. Now, Kindle won't. Now, there's a workaround where you can read PDFs, and that's great. Now I offer PDFs of the book, but I still think it's a little... It's a little bit of, like, an advantage for iBooks. Because before, like, when I talked about it in, you know, episode number 28, I think you'd find that I talked about how Kindle has some advantages. So here I am talking about iBooks' advantages. So it kind of... It evens the ledger a little bit, I think. But, you know, Kindle still has the flexibility of reading on, you know, desktop, you know, computers and other stuff. But I still, you know, I do think that going with that open format and making stuff readable is a very nice feature.
Yeah, well, I think the battle of, you know, reader apps comes down to the UX experience.
Oh, yeah.
And really designing...
Sure.
Something because, you know, people can get the books pretty much anywhere. You know, publishers will sell to all three of those channels. You know, they're probably not doing a lot of exclusivities, although they might try to start to play that game like gaming consoles did. But, you know, right now, users want a really great experience. So that's
right.
Where the challenge is.
They absolutely.
Bring on a new type of thinking into their business.
Yeah, I mean... You know, I think we're looking at an alliance now between Microsoft and Barnes & Noble. So they have the Nook, and that for at first there was a lawsuit between them. Like Microsoft was suing Barnes & Noble over their use of Android on the Nook. And then they settled and now they're partners.
Interesting.
And so what's going on is, like, people are speculating, are they going to make, like, a Nook Fire, you know? Like, but it's going to run Windows RT? Like, you know, the version of Windows 8 that's touch, like, only, basically, and runs on ARM? You know, runs on the lighter Surface tablet?
How soon did the two companies declare a partnership?
It was, I don't want to say some months ago, but that's just ballpark.
Hmm.
Sorry?
I guess my thought is they both kind of seem like behemoth companies. I don't know if Barnes & Noble has like a parent company.
No, they're their own company still, and they're one of those, I mean, they're the one of the those left. Like, it's a tough market, right? Because Borders was bankrupt and liquidated.
I mean, if it's a true, like, product... share kind of partnership versus more like a marketing one or so like a deeper integration and, you know, exchanging of ideas and whatever and all that kind of stuff. That might take a while unless somebody came to the table with something ready to go and the other person was like, all you have to do is sign on and, you know, we can start doing this, but I don't know.
Now, I think it's a platform issue. Let's put it this way. Now, I think some Android tablets will come with Kindle pre-installed. Now, you look at a company like Samsung, and I think they want, people to use their own, well, I mean, you know, I know that there's Google Play Books, and there's also, you know, Kindle Books, and, I think there's a Nook app, and, you know, I know there's some Samsung stuff. I'm not sure if they do their own ebook stuff, but I know Sony does. There's a lot of players in the market. Now, Kindle is the biggest, but Kindle is a big company in Seattle. I mean, it's not clear that Microsoft would want to have a partnership right at a time like now where all these huge companies are competing against each other. It doesn't seem like they would be likely to install a Kindle app right at default on Windows 8. But maybe they would or have. I don't know. But I don't really think so, right? Like, here's their thing. Do they build their own platform? Google Play, they have their own book platform. Apple has the iBooks platform. Amazon Kindle is still the most popular one. But what's one of their biggest competitors? I mean, Sony's out there.
I don't know, you know, I don't know if they've really done much, but this is a company that's made a lot of popular hardware in the past, and they could come up with a sleek looking, you know, reader now, because this is the an area that's the, where the pace has been set, not by Apple, or even by, you know, whatever, Motorola or Samsung, but by Amazon. And Amazon is known for a lot of things, but maybe not their cutting edge industrial design, at least not yet. So, you know, their stuff looks clunky, right? Those old Kindles, they look like weird old typewriters.
Yeah.
Small keys.
I do, I think that in the show notes, you know, you posted your tweets, and I think, you know, you sort of smelled the scent of desperation, and, you know, the strategy of Microsoft is hinged upon one thing and one thing only. And then when they go off and do something like this, people are like, what are they doing? Why are they doing that? Are they trying to get in this game now? Like, do they have any idea what they're doing? And you're, I mean, when you're questioning,
yeah, you're right. See, like no, I really question whether they know what they're doing. But so I'm attributing too much and thinking there's some strategy. But I think the thing is, I mean, just to complete my speculation, if they're going to put something default level into Windows, or if they're going to encourage their partners to do so or whatever on default on machines, then maybe they'll deal with Barnes & Noble and the Nook ecosystem and put their resources behind building that up, because that's their partner, rather than Kindle or somebody else. Because it's already splintered after Kindle. So every book publisher, there must be some syndicate that you can have just sell. Like, maybe that's what publishers are still for, or maybe even, you know, maybe they have go-betweens. I guess maybe small authors maybe just go on Kindle or one or two other things, and that's okay, right? But if you have a mass book, I guess, you know, you have, like, people that do multiple, you know, set up on multiple sites. But, like, you know, the Sony reader store, like, you probably don't want to say no to that money if you have, like, Tom Clancy or somebody as you know, your author. Now, if you're a small author, I guess you can say, no, you got to come find me where I am. Or even preferably give out DRM-free ebooks. I mean, you know, my stuff is it's generated by Apple programs, but as far as I know, it's DRM free. It's certainly intended to be by me. The two things are put out by the iBooks creator, and then one by Pages. So it's Apple stuff. But I don't, you know, I don't think they're a company to put third party random tracking stuff on things. But you know, ebook stuff like DRM, like, that's the thing. I guess that's part of why Kindle doesn't allow EPUB. But I mean, it's just, I don't know why they don't do that, because, I mean, it's just for indie books, and you can sideload them, or people that want to share their stuff, you know, or maybe people sharing manuscripts and using it with EPUB, so people can look at e-readers with each other's stuff, you know, like, so a good use for that, and that just makes you think, like, well, that's a nice thing to have, you know, an Apple device for reading, you know, just sideloaded EPUBs. Now, I guess on Android there are, like, I shouldn't be narrow-minded about Android, because it's really Kindle that's limiting me, you know, like the Kindle app on Android. I probably could find some apps that could run EPUB on Android. That's probably pretty possible, right? But in terms of having that all in that one store and stuff.
No, I think it's great, and I think it's good that you have the Android tablet, because, you know, you make the sacrifice for all of us. Oh! Everybody knows how great Apple products are.
That's the closest thing I have to a bell. That's that you win the podcast right there. Oh, that's as good as it's gonna do. You know, it's hard to find a bell like sound on the internet. You know, I want to have a soundboard with like a bell and a few other things.
We should get some more musical instruments.
Maybe I'll just clear out that noise I made and replace it with the bell sound, so people just heard a bell instead of that clunking that I did.
That would be very nice of you.
Bottle against the... Yeah, sure. So I had some tweets that I wrote out on the show notes, and you can find the show notes at djmcloud.com. Look for show notes for episode number 59. And this is the DJM Cloud podcast with me, Dan McKeown, and with Jessica McKeown.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me on here.
Yeah.
I always enjoy it.
You can find out more about Jessica's up to by checking her Twitter at Jessica McKeown, all one word, and her URL is at
jessica.sf3am.com.
Cool. And if you want to send feedback to the podcast, send us an email at feedback2012@sf3am.com. And if you want to see more information about the podcast on iTunes, just go to the homepage, djmcloud.com, and there'll be a link there to that and other stuff. So back to that list that I wrote about Microsoft products. So I wrote a bunch of tweets. So basically, most who claim garbage Windows Phone 8 looks, quote, pretty cool, unquote, are never going to use it. Being a bunch of iOS users, second choice means nothing. WebOS was the second choice of iPhone users everywhere, had subpar hardware, was run by a sclerotic, aimless corporation like Windows Phone 8. Short alert on MSFT stock, I now expect them to be insolvent by the end of the decade. The holiday season is going to be such a catastrophe for Microsoft that it will start an irreversible, slow motion collapse of Windows 8.
Yep, it's on its way down, and free software is hopefully on its way up.
Yeah, that would be cool if that happened. I think that people are going to choose proprietary and free software in some mix that's going to replace, though, their use of Microsoft stuff for the most part. Now, we have one install of Microsoft Office in this house, but other than that, we have basically a Microsoft-free house. Now, we got a Malibu, Chevrolet Malibu, instead of a... there were alternatives out there, but one of them was the Ford Fusion.
Yes.
Remember it had the Microsoft Sync? Ugh. You bristled at that right away.
Immediately, and I thought, well, if the car's really great, maybe I could get over it.
Turns out the car wasn't that good at all. Yeah.
And the Microsoft thing made it even worse, I think.
Yeah, the car just didn't have the feel in its terms of interior or the... Or the road grip and kind of just sturdiness that the Malibu seemed to have, I don't know much about cars, but someone who does know a lot about cars was sitting in on our last podcast, Jim. So we actually did have the three of us in the same room recording. For the first time, I think, in the history of the podcast, for episode 58, the Thanksgiving special.
That was a special episode.
Yeah, like 8 minutes of us recounting the pace of life when you're back at your parents' house. In this case, my parents' house for Thanksgiving weekend. We go to different family, events for Thanksgiving and stuff like that, but... this time it was fun, but different.
Yeah.
And so Jim just briefly appears in the podcast, but he is there. And we certainly hang out in person, like the three of us, a lot, but, when there's holidays or family events or when he comes by and visits us. But, in terms of actually recording the podcast, it's not something we think to do. Sometimes, like, we go in and connect to him through FaceTime. And that's how we've done it before.
Yeah. It's great to use that technology to have guests on.
Well, yeah, but then we'd have to have a different computer running or run the same computer. Think about it now. Now that we're not with the better microphone, it would actually be harder to just pipe in his FaceTime sound. Like, we'd have to have this other computer running with its whirring fan. I was tweeting about the fan today in this thing. It's like, now, on the one hand, it's very loud because when it's quiet... Well, I mean, it's quiet now, but, in the microphone, you hear it very much so in a lot of the podcast recordings.
Yeah, well, I'll have to look into getting a dampener for that or getting in the computer.
Well, yeah, we have we're using the MacBook Pro instead of the iMac to run GarageBand now and record this, and that works pretty well. because that MacBook Pro usually runs pretty quiet. But, like, the sound of the MacBook Pro can take over at some point, and it has a little bit of, like, a jet sound. But the iMac, I was saying, you know, on Twitter, like, it's kind of a whirl sound, but, like, you know, it's actually a nice sound, like a well balanced, well lined fan sound, you know, like it's not some clattery fan. But then Jim reminded me on Twitter that there was like if there was a new Apple fan technology, and he was wondering if I could take this thing apart and try to install the new fan system. But I don't know if that'll be possible.
We wanted to tint our windows and put in a new stereo system.
New head unit.
Yeah, and give us probably some fat tires and LED something.
Yeah, we got like the 18-inch tires on our Malibu. We have pretty big tires for our consumer car.
He sees everything as something that can be more, better, bigger, faster, stronger with cars, so...
Yeah, well, definitely, he knows a lot about that stuff.
The tricked out view of our Malibu.
Oh yeah, there's a lot you can do with the Malibu, because it's a widely bought car. It's a widely owned car, so that there's a lot of different, you know, aftermarket modifications for it. Now you were talking about some aftermarket modifications that you were reading about online that I don't know. I guess sounded fascinating. I don't know how well they would work, but like, for example, reusing K-cups by jamming grounds in there and then covering it up with foil again. I mean...
Yes, there's quite a few bloggers who have posts about reusing K-cups and all different sorts of solutions and ideas. A lot of them kind of on the eco-friendly side of reusing.
Yeah, but the foil, I was starting to wonder about, like, if you use grounds and foil, do you know what I mean? How much are you reusing, and how much of it is the paper? I don't know.
Well, I think these people probably threw out their coffee pots when they got their K-cups. Now they're realizing... I'd pay $1 something for every cup of coffee, or this isn't really eco, or...
They have some other pouches, too, on Amazon that I saw, some alternative shape pouches, and I'm like, I don't know if I want to put this on my new machine, like the different shape, you know, like, because that machine that we referred to in the last podcast, it has materialized, and I was making pot with coffee with it, K-cups, and I like that. Yeah, I might use that attachment that allows me to make it with grounds, but I like having it working.
Good. It was a birthday present, because your birthday's coming up, and you get a little early surprise and some coffee from me. And what's your favorite flavor?
Well, I like the Jet Fuel K-Cups that I've tried, but I really like the Sumatra Starbucks ones that you gave me.
I had that for breakfast.
Oh, you had that breakfast? Because I noticed the breakfast one hadn't been open, so I didn't know if maybe you hadn't had one for breakfast, but you had the Sumatra. Because I want to have some of both of those, yeah, for sure.
Not a morning and coffee.
One thing I was wondering, like, okay, so now I found that Levi's, because my main pair of pants, like, I'm not one of those people who's written a blog post about wearing the same thing every day, but I basically wear, like, Levi's 527s, or I have a few pairs of 505s and like one pair of Eddie Bauer jeans, but that's about it in terms of what I. Then I have like a pair of Carpenter jeans and khakis, but I don't really wear those very often at all. But like, you know, so then I have like a shirt, you know, or sweatshirt or something like that, and that's about it, you know.
Socks and slippers.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Couple, you know.
Tennis shoes.
Yeah.
New Balance shoes, sometimes boots.
Yeah, Puma or New Balance shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, okay, so the thing is, what if I can plug in something that's 25% less, or maybe even less, at Target? So Levi's has a sub-brand called Denizen, and I guess they're trying to push into something bigger, and they've retrenched that recently, but they're like, you know, Denizen by Levi, whatever. So it's 20% polyester, or roughly, and like 80% cotton instead of 100% cotton. But I don't know. I don't know if that's really a downside or not. But then otherwise, they're fairly similar. And I think that the Denizen 233, they have something like the low boot cut, like whatever. It says, I think it's basically supposed to be the equivalent of the Levi's 527.
And there's an interesting story behind these jeans and how they came to be in America, right?
Well, apparently it was a big brand that... Levi's was pushing the brand. As far as, like, the couple articles I looked at quickly, Levi's had been pushing Denizen as a brand in Asia and maybe a few other places. And... you know, had done a lot of, I mean, it's a big company, so they'd done a lot to support that. And then just recently they declared that they were folding that tent. They were going to push the Levi's brand in those markets, but that for now it seemed useful to keep the brand at Target. So in a way it's becoming like a house brand with Levi's and Target. But I guess Target does that a lot, you know, with like they'll do deals with other brands or whatever. So I got one pair, and I'm going to try them and just see. Because, you know, what's the real... I guess there's the difference of what they're made out of, but, you know, polyester, I mean, 20%, whatever. I guess maybe they shrink a little less slowly, but it probably doesn't really make any difference. And, you know, like, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that they'll be worth the 25% discount?
You know, I also have a pair, and I bought them not at Target, not knowing that they were associated with Levi. I didn't see that on my label.
Maybe they don't push it on the other labels as much on women's. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Because there's so many different brands of jeans for women these days, I guess. But I'm excited to see how they last. I think they'll do better. You know, they might have a bit more stretch and give and keep the shape and... that might be good.
How long have you had those ones for?
Not even a month.
So you know, can't really make much judgment on.
No, 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 no.
Well, I have this book that I've actually been reading for a number of years. But the book is called 2012, so I guess this is a good year to finish reading it.
Perfect timing.
Well, there's this, like, lot of subject matter that this book covers, and it kind of goes over a lot of stuff all the way from Eastern, religious ideas to New Age spirituality, Native American stuff. It talks a lot about Christianity, actually. Not a lot of Judaism per se, but Jewish culture that he comes from, New York. I guess even a few references to Kabbalah. But you know, just all this different stuff that, he talks about psychedelic drugs like ayahuasca and iboga and a lot of stuff like that. And it's one of those sprawling books that synthesizes a lot of ideas. So it contains some pretty thin threads. Some of the stuff. I mean, he talks about all of the different people that he talked to, like somebody that's working on a different calendar, but then, you know, he has a lot of criticisms of that calendar, so it's like, you know, well, is that great person to be talking about? Maybe like a lot of stuff where, you know, everybody has these different ideas, so the psychedelic explorer has to go and look investigate all the different angles and write about it. So, you know, maybe he sees the author is Daniel Pinchbeck. I guess he might see himself as sort of a, one of the writers in the field that Terence McKenna used to say inhabit. And, there's a lot of stuff in there. I guess, I have a handful of stuff flagged for different reasons, so I was going to, like, flip through and read some quotes.
Great.
Do This approaching milestone also marks a rare astronomical event, the alignment of the Earth and the Sun with the, quote, dark rift, unquote, at the center of the Milky Way on the winter solstice of December 21st, 2012. The particular date is less important than the Mayan perspective, as the independent Mayan scholar John Major Jenkins puts it, that, quote, that around the year 2012, a large chapter in human history will be coming to an end. All the values and assumptions of the previous world age will expire, and a new phase of human growth will commence, unquote. Unquote. That's on page 12 of the paperback version that I have. The book is called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
And what is that?
That's like this Amerindian bird god, I guess. You know, something in one of the mythologies down there. And, you know, like people, a lot of people will go and do that ayahuasca or yaje or whatever, that stuff. Do that in South America. And then there's all these different churches that have that as their sacrament. And I think there's even some in the U.S. What do you think of that stuff?
I don't know what it is or what it does.
I guess it's a pretty heavy dose. Like, a lot of people take it and then they throw up. But then they, you know, then they have it's a strong psychedelic. It can make people, I guess, maybe kind of like hallucinate. But I think what it does is it connects people to, people say, you know, people report it connecting to them to like a plant intelligence or something like that. And, you know, it's a plant itself from the jungle. So maybe it's a little bit like psilocybin mushrooms. But then again, I mean, I guess some people get sick when they do psilocybin mushrooms. But I think almost everybody gets, like, sick from the ayahuasca. But also there's that ibogaine or iboga stuff, which is like the West African kind of, you know, psychedelic. And some people have recommended that for treatment for certain things. Like, it has a strong element of having people confront themselves. Like, it's, you know, there's that kind of haunted West African vibe to it, especially when people go and do that there with the tribes, the Bwiti tribes. So this kind of stuff was covered in his previous book too, Breaking Open the Head, I think it was called. But this book goes out like very wide into like a lot of different theories and speculations, and then his travels. And one of the things he gets really into is the whole crop circle thing, centered around kind of Glastonbury, England, I guess, where there's that music festival too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What about it?
Well, I guess he sees the crop circles as sort of a mystery for the New Age, or I, you know, don't let me speak for the author. But outside of actually quoting him, but you know, like there's a certain kind of like a group of people that gather around the crop circles. There's people that claim that they're all hoaxes and they do hoaxes themselves, but then there's people that say that there's never been anybody caught hoaxing at the kind of precision and quality that a lot of the unexplained circles are from. And then there's Stonehenge nearby. Now, I've actually been to Stonehenge. It's pretty cool.
I have never been there, but I've seen the photos and have always wanted to go.
Yeah, you saw my photos of it, right?
I did.
Yeah, from 1999. Yeah, so I think, like, if I go through and if I look on this book on page 296, I notice I underlined the word black helicopter. So, I don't know. It's kind of out of context. I have to go read back to see what it's about. He talks about Minonan culture in 322. I mean, you know, it's pretty out there, right? Like Crete, ancient Crete.
What does he say about ancient Crete?
Some passing reference. Let me see.
How does he know?
While historical civilizations enshrined a monotheistic, quote, God the Father, unquote, many prehistoric cultures worship the, quote, Great Mother, unquote. Indo-European examples include the pre-Hellenic goddess worshipping Minonan culture on Crete and Catalhaic, which flourished in Turkey more than 5,000 years before Christ. What he says. Now, you know, Crete, there was Minoan and Mycenaean culture, and that was sort of like an early Greek thing, and it was based around the islands and based on trading and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he's saying that they had a, you know, a different kind of system of, like, goddesses instead of gods. And you know, I don't know about their mythology, so that's an interesting observation. Another thing that he talks about is the number 13. I think in this book, like, you know, the number 13, people have superstition against it.
Yes.
And he says it's traditionally associated with feminine things. It's a number that represents like what the whatever mechanistic patriarchy considers a, you know, an uneven number, but actually has like a natural beauty and symmetry, or I don't know if that's the right word, you know, to it, and that, you know, like it's a good number, I guess, if that's the way, I don't know if that's
the way you put it. What's the beauty and symmetry of 13?
You know what, I'd have to get, one would have to delve into this book to hear the way he explains it. But I mean, there is something about 13, like it is worth questioning why there's some sort of, like, superstition, prohibition on the use of the number. Is there really anything wrong with that?
No, and I've always been like, when you go to hotels and they don't have a 13th floor, I always tell the people on the 14th floor, you're really on the 13th floor.
Yeah, I mean, that might be a true observation.
They have a 13th floor, there's just no rooms on it. So they go to the extent of wasting space.
Yeah, but I think that most buildings simply don't have any building in that space. I'm not an architect, but yeah, I mean, and even that, I think that some places might have a heating and cooling level. There are some office buildings that essentially have floors. Sometimes they're essentially subfloors that are basically just dedicated. Maybe they're half floors, you know, just dedicated to heating and cooling systems, which have to be piled up along with the building somewhere.
Right.
I don't know if they're going to heat and cool a large building.
No. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. Some people said it was where the mob has their offices.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. So, on page 391 of this book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl by Daniel Pinchbeck, although we do not know how the classic Maya interpreted the prophetic culmination of their long count, Carl Johan Kalman has established a meticulously exact fractal model of time from the Mayan calendar, in which human consciousness evolves through 9 underworlds, each 20 times faster in linear time than the previous one. So that gives you an idea of the prose of this book. But also, the first part of that sentence gives you an idea that maybe there's a lot of ambiguity about what that means at the end of the long count calendar or whatever. But, you know, it might just be the end of the scope of that particular calendar, and, you know, you know, like the idea that maybe there's time for a new calendar. And here's a term that it says, you know, just before the one I just read, you know, on page 389, there's something I underlined out of context, sort of, as the fourth world comes to an end. And I just thought that was kind of interesting because, you know, like in the Lord of the Rings, they talk about the third age and all that kind of thing. So,
yes.
I mean, anyway, so do you think something's going to change with the new alignment?
What alignment?
The planets were to make it December 21st, 2012.
I think I can already feel the shift in consciousness, so I think this could be a time when it really does end. It'd be nice. I can't foresee any big event happening.
Well, on page 243, it says, quote, in night 5, ruled by Tezcatlipoca, the Lord of Darkness, we will see the last desperate and at the same time most forceful attempt to secure control by the forces seeking to maintain dominance, unquote. Such an interregnum could also provide the opportunity to circulate a new vision of what this world could be and disseminate the tools and principles to implement it. End of quote. So I guess, you know, yeah, that's an opportunity maybe if things are, if consciousness is changing, like you said. So check the show notes if you want to see a link to this. There's a link to the paperback in the show notes, but you can also click to get the Kindle version or whatever. You can see for yourself about this book if you want to check it out. And thanks, Jessica, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So it's been podcast 59 of the DJMCloud.com podcast. Recorded on November 29th, 2012.